Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how billions of tax dollars are lavished on sports teams, big corporations, TV and movie studios, and casinos, while schools and civil servants are asked to pinch every penny. We'll spend this hour with Pat Garofalo of Talk Poverty, who's been investigating the origins of the huge tax breaks dangled in front of private enterprise to lure them to cities and states. The idea is that spending huge sums on incentives pays off in the long run in the form of new jobs for local people. But as Garofalo will tell us, the numbers almost never add up the way they're supposed to. And the sweet deals taxpayers are asked to finance often have nothing to do with whether a company does business where you live. Our conversation starts after a short break. Almost 20 years ago now, a group of civic-minded leaders in Dallas got a big idea. They wanted to host the Summer Olympics. The Dallas 2012 campaign was born, culminating in a 600-page proposal, days of wining and dining Olympic site committee officials, and pledges of billions of dollars in investment if only the games could happen in Big D. To the dismay of many Dallasites, London won the competition to host that year. But if you look at it another way, through the lens of fiscal responsibility, maybe Dallas dodged a bullet. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We've become accustomed to metro areas falling over themselves to placate sports teams and lure corporations with enormous tax discounts. Case in point, the nationwide frenzy over HQ2 for Amazon. Sure, there's an upfront cost, or in the case of stadiums, maybe a 25-year bond issue to pay off. We agree to it hoping to draw jobs, which often don't materialize as promised. But as my guest has discovered, the companies enjoying all this tax-funded free money are almost never held accountable for failing to deliver. Pat Garofalo is managing editor for TalkPoverty.org at the Center for American Progress. His book is called The Billionaire Boondoggle: How Our Politicians Let Corporations and Bigwigs Steal Our Money and Jobs. He joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington to talk about it. Pat, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with Amazon. Company picks Queens, New York, and then withdraws the plan after locals complain. This is a really unusual course of events, but after reading your book, I think maybe the people of Queens were onto something.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a very unique instance in which one of these corporate tax deals was really in the public eye for a long time, right? Amazon held this nationwide auction for its second headquarters. Hundreds of cities piled in. They whittled it down to 20 finalists, collected data on those cities, and then picked the suburbs of D.C. and New York to plant their second headquarters. And because of all that attention, a ton of attention was paid to the downsides as well, which if you read my book, you'll find is almost never the case when it comes to these corporate tax giveaways.
I had no idea that this practice of corporate tax giveaways is nearly as old as the United States itself.
Absolutely. The very first one, 1791, to Alexander Hamilton, of all people.
And how did that work out?
It really didn't. His plan was to set up a manufacturing hub in Paterson, New Jersey. Within 5 years of receiving the tax break, there was no manufacturing happening on the site at all. A few of his buddies got busted for corruption, and it wasn't until decades later, actually, that Paterson did finally manage to seize its potential to be a manufacturing center.
So the idea is that all these deals will bring new jobs to an area, which sounds like a good thing. I was really surprised to learn that there are no guarantees that the number of jobs pledged will be fulfilled, and really no consequences in most of these cases if the jobs don't happen.
Absolutely. The transparency on these deals is really bad. Over the last few years, you have seen a few more instances in which a company is actually held responsible for a certain level of job creation. That was the case with Foxconn in Wisconsin, a sort of recent famous deal that fell through. But for the most part, there's no accountability on these deals whatsoever. There was a study that came out in New Jersey a few weeks ago, and it showed that their corporate tax incentive programs had just been trundling along for years, and no one was going to check up on them. And they had 3,000 jobs that were appearing on one ledger and not appearing on another, and just nobody could figure out where those jobs were or where they went or if they were ever created at all. And that's the case in most places. There was a study 2 years ago, I want to say, that showed about half of the counties that give out corporate tax incentives literally don't list the recipients at all. They just say, we spent $25 million on stuff.
And in some cases, you found cities are spending upwards of $200,000 per job added to a local economy.
Absolutely. There's a problem with these programs wherein even if they do actually create new positions, because you're laundering money through a corporation rather than just, you know, creating the job outright or spending to support some other social good, you end up paying a humongous premium for these things. And that makes sense, right? If you're giving Amazon money, even if Amazon does create some jobs in the local economy, some of the people that get those jobs are going to be flown in from elsewhere, because Amazon's not just going to, you know, hire only unemployed people. They're going to move people around. And also, some of the money that Amazon gets is inevitably going to leak out back to Amazon headquarters in Seattle. There's no way to keep all of that money contained in the local economy. So that's how you end up getting these outrageous price per job numbers.
Well, we'll talk about this. When you say giving Amazon money, are we giving money to these entities, or are we simply saying you're going to get a discount on the taxes that you would pay if you were an existing company operating in this area?
Absolutely. It depends. There's no really perfect way to talk about these things in the aggregate. And I definitely use shorthand when I say, you know, tossing cash at a corporation. These breaks come in all sorts of different forms. A break on your property taxes. Maybe you get your payroll taxes back in a lump sum. Maybe you just get land for free. You know, you don't have to pay to acquire the land on which you're going to build. But the big takeaway is that this is opportunity cost, right? This is money that could have been spent on basically anything else. This is money that doesn't go to schools, that doesn't go to roads, that doesn't go to the healthcare system. If there's the will to say, hey, let's give a tax break to Amazon, there should be the will to say, hey, we had that money in the coffer and we should use it for something else.
How do cities make up for the money that they're not receiving in revenue from these big employers?
That's a great question. I don't know sort of nationwide or in any sort of systematic way, but my guess would be that you end up pushing it down the income ladder, right? When states and cities can't raise money from the corporate level, they're probably often resulting to things like sales taxes or property taxes or those sorts of things. You know, states don't rely on income taxes very much at all. They tend to rely on things like sales and property. And so every dollar you can't collect from an Amazon means one more you have to collect from someone somewhere else, because most cities and states have to constitutionally balance their budgets. They're not allowed to, like the federal government, run a deficit.
Okay, so maybe a city or state and its leaders are saying, we know this is really expensive, but we want jobs in this area. What do we know, Pat, about the extent to which tax deals and other forms of corporate welfare actually play into decisions about where to locate facilities?
The quick and dirty answer is that they really don't. And that's one of the problems with these deals, is you end up oftentimes paying companies to do things that they would have done anyway. And I'll use two examples. One is, of course, Amazon, which conducts this nationwide search, gets the hopes up of cities all across America. And where do they go? The nation's capital and the world capital of finance, right? There were really good reasons for Amazon to be in both of those places now that have absolutely nothing to do with taxes, right? Amazon just got a giant Pentagon contract. Being in New York makes sense because that's where all the money is. And if it was only purely about the incentives, Amazon would have gone to Newark, New Jersey, which offered it substantially more, or Montgomery County, Maryland, which offered it substantially more. So there was definitely a portion of the decision that was not about the tax breaks at all. And I would argue they were probably likely to go to D.C. and New York the entire time. Another good example is actually right in Dallas, where you guys had a Toyota consolidate a few offices and come in. And 2014, I want to say, and you can correct me if that's wrong, got some $40 million and afterwards had executives saying, yeah, there were good business reasons for us to be here that had nothing to do with taxes. It made sense for our supply chains. It made sense for our quality of life for our workers. It made communications easier. But thanks for the money.
Wow. And of course, even if cities or states don't win these bids that they make, these offers that they use to try and attract these facilities, there's a cost to that, right? There's a cost to preparing a package of incentives, to bringing people in and taking them out on the town.
Yeah, 100%. And there's staff time, and you know, people are preparing slides, and they're running the numbers, and they're, you know, crunching and making sure that they have all the money available. There's time spent when you have to push a bill through a legislature. That's, you know, lobbying time on whatever your Capitol Hill is. So yeah, there's absolutely a cost to these things, even if you end up losing the competition.
Okay, a permanent or presumably permanent corporate headquarters or manufacturing facility is one thing. I want to talk about special events. Cities are known all over the world, really, to fall all over themselves competing to host the Super Bowl, or in the U.S., the Super Bowl, the Olympics, and the World Cup elsewhere. What is the assumption about what these limited time events will do for a host city?
So the assumption is that it'll do a few things. One, it'll be a kind of infomercial for the city, right? We'll be on the world stage for 2 weeks and everyone's going to see it and lots of people are going to want to come here. And the second part is that it will quite literally create jobs and boost the economy because visitors will come in, they'll spend money in the local bars and restaurants, they'll buy some stuff, they'll have to stay in the local hotel. And that's all activity that wouldn't have happened anyway, right? And so those are the sort of two prongs that cities are counting on when they bid on these sorts of events.
Okay, but what happens is, as you explain in the book, for everybody who comes in because they want to attend these special events, there are other people who aren't there that would be there for another reason at another time. In other words, they don't want to visit Sydney during the Olympics, so they'll hold off their trip.
Absolutely, 100%. It's called the substitution effect. And you see it around big events like the Olympics. You see it around just other sports-related deals, like when a city pays to have a baseball stadium or a hockey arena or whatever the case may be. People realize that that event is there. And if you were going to, say my home of Washington, D.C. was going to host the Olympics, if you were planning to come to D.C. and you didn't want to be in part of the, Olympic hoopla or be stuck in all the security measures or deal with all the traffic, you might push your trip to next year. Or someone like me who lives here, whereas I would usually on Wednesday night go out to a restaurant, go down to a bar, do whatever, I'm going to stay home because, you know, downtown's going to be a mess. And that decision often doesn't get accounted. We treat every new visitor to a city as if they're just new on top of everything that already occurs. But those additions also displace other spending that would have happened because people are like, oh, no way, I'm absolutely not going anywhere near this circus.
At least if you're having a World Cup tournament or a Super Bowl, you probably, you know, presumably already have a stadium in place, that sort of thing. The Olympics these days almost always comes with this requirement to build, you know, natatoriums and stadiums and different new facilities. How exactly are cities trying to pay off all this stuff that they may not have a use for after that 2 or 3 weeks?
Yeah, it goes really badly. The most famous example is Montreal, way back in 1976, spent 30 years paying off its Olympic Stadium, which actually wasn't even finished when the Olympics occurred there. They were still, slamming in hammers and nails as the athletes were showing up. That's the really famous example, but this has happened all over the world. Less so in the U.S., honestly, because we tend to have big facilities, because we have NFL teams, we have NHL teams, we have NBA teams. So we tend to have the sorts of facilities that could feasibly host an Olympic Games. But for the rest of the world, it's been really bad, particularly if you look at South Africa, if you look at Athens, if you look at Rio de Janeiro. They have these giant stadiums that they just don't need, and the local teams can't draw enough people in to make even the upkeep worth the cost.
Well, some people might say, sure, the stadiums maybe are extraneous, but we put all this money into infrastructure. Suddenly our metro system is working better than it ever has been. What's your response to that?
This is my favorite argument, because this often happens again. I keep bringing it back to D.C. because we've sort of experienced the whole spectrum of this thing without ever actually winning the Olympics, thank goodness. And that's what happens is the lawmakers come out and they say, hey, if we get to host the Olympics, we'll plow all this money into our roads and into our metro. And my question always is, if you have the will to spend on the metro and wider infrastructure for the Olympics, why don't you have the will to just do that? We could really use some subway upgrades in this city. Why does it take spending all this money on other stuff we don't need in order to justify the cost of spending on the subway?
So is there an answer? I know that's a rhetorical question, but is there a reason that you can get people behind this kind of spending only when there's a special event attached?
Because it sounds special, right? The problem with the argument I am making is that the counter argument sounds good, right? We're going to spend money on this thing, and all these people are going to come, and it's going to be great, and we're going to get rich from it. Or we're going to bring in HQ2 in, and it's going to be great, and there are going to be all these jobs, and we're going to be rich because of it. That's a really kind of simple, satisfying story, right, that like feels right in your gut. Whereas people like me come in and start going, well, if you account for the substitution effect and the leakages and womp, 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 we're like the teacher in Charlie Brown, right? So at a gut level, we've been told this story about how to build business in the U.S. for decades, if not centuries, and it's just a hard narrative to fight back against.
My guest is Pat Garofalo. He's managing editor for TalkPoverty.org at the Center for American Progress, and he has a new book out called The Billionaire Boondoggle: How Our Politicians Let Corporations and Bigwigs Steal Our Money and Jobs. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with Pat Garofalo, who's managing editor for TalkPoverty.org at the Center for American Progress. His book is called The Billionaire Boondoggle: How Our Politicians Let Corporations and Bigwigs Steal Our Money and Jobs. You can join us by calling 800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERAThink. All right, Pat, not everything is quantifiable in a really easy way. What about the soft benefits like marketing prospects? Surely 2 or 3 weeks of global TV coverage of one city functions like free tourism advertising, right? Maybe the benefit from something like the Olympics plays out over 20 years.
Absolutely. There are instances where that has happened. I think the most famous one is the Barcelona Olympics, which really did put that city on the map in a way it hadn't been before. It had been kind of overshadowed by the other cities in Spain. And so there really was a two-week infomercial for the city, and I think there was a tourism dividend. But that sort of breaks down when you start talking about a place like London or Washington, D.C. or New York or Paris, right? Like, is anybody not aware that Paris is there or what's in Paris? They're going to watch the TV. Huh, that's a really big, cool-looking tower. What is that? So yeah, I think that sort of breaks down once you get to these like world-class, world-known cities that really don't need to spend a ton of money on a two-week infomercial.
Okay, before we move away from sports, how have we arrived at a time when many major sports teams, which are for-profit, right, they're owned by people trying to make money, why are the stadiums partially or entirely bankrolled by taxpayers in many cities?
So there are two things going on. One is that the owners have gotten very good at telling this story about job creation and economic boosting and all that good stuff. If you build us a stadium, we will create all these jobs. We will revitalize local neighborhoods. We will do all these great things. It's going to be awesome. Having a baseball team in your city will make you rich. So that's part one, and they've gotten very good at telling that story. And again, kind of at a gut level, makes sense, right? All these people are going to be in the stadium. They're going to go to the bar before and after. It's going to be awesome for the local neighborhood. But then part two is that sports owners always have a nuclear bomb to drop, right? They can always take the team and move and, you know, rip a team away from a city. We've seen it over and over and over again. And so since they can always do that, and like that just dread of fans of seeing their team play in another city wearing different colors, but also local politicians, you never want to be the guy who lost the team, right? You don't want to be the person who lost the Cleveland Browns to Baltimore, or who lost the Seattle Supersonics to Oklahoma City. You don't want to be that guy. That's probably really bad for your reelection prospects. And so lawmakers end up telling the same story as the owners, even if it's mostly nonsense, that this is going to be awesome for your local economy, because they're afraid of what happens if the team leaves.
I think the thing that always occurs to me is that a lot of these professional sports teams sell tickets, especially in the case of the NFL, that are frankly far too expensive for most of the residents of the cities asked to pay for them.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. It's always to ask not just are there going to be benefits, but benefits for whom, right? You see this. Actually, again, I keep coming back to D.C. because we have all these problems. We built a baseball stadium for the Washington Nationals, $750 million. And there has absolutely been development in the neighborhood around the stadium. There's a winery. There's a brewery. There are all these cool coffee shops. There are like giant high-rise apartment buildings going up. And so everyone goes, see, it worked. To which my two responses are, one, that's happening across D.C. and all these other neighborhoods managed to do so without having a baseball stadium built, and it's just the kind of general economic trend, so I don't think it was the stadium's fault. But two, that displaced people, and there are people who can no longer afford to live in that neighborhood because of the stadium being there, driving rents up, driving those property values up. So the question when assessing these deals is not just, is there going to be a benefit? And oftentimes I say no, but whatever results do occur, who is that going to benefit? And if it's only benefiting the wealthiest people in the city, or it's only benefiting the team owners and a bunch of wealthy real estate developers, then why on earth are we doing this?
Okay, these days, the usable life of a stadium is, I don't know, 20, 25 years. Why do teams start lobbying for new facilities before the bond issues that finance the original ones are paid off?
Oh, that's the worst. These cities that are still paying for the old stadium when they start paying for the new stadium,
right?
Again, it's because owners are really good at telling a story, and they always have the threat of the team leaving. So they can say, hey, our 20-year-old stadium is obsolete, and we need more luxury boxes. And if you don't, then we're going to move our team to, you know, the current bogeyman in the NFL is probably London, right? For years, it was Los Angeles. It was, if you don't give us new luxury boxes, we're going to move to LA. Now, that's sort of off the table, so I think it's probably London now. But that just threat of we will rip the heart out of your community, all of you fans who are really invested in this team. Maybe your dad, taught you how to be a fan and brought you to the ballpark, and you have all these great memories. We're gonna rip it away unless you build us a new stadium that helps us make more money.
But how is a stadium? This is the part I don't get. How is a new modern stadium obsolete after 20 years? Like maybe,
I mean, it's not.
Right. Okay.
It's the really easy answer.
So it's not like they did poor construction in the first place or something. It's just that it's and then what's the benefit to the team? I can't imagine, even 20 extra luxury boxes are going to generate that much extra revenue. Is it just about getting people excited again about attending that stadium?
Yeah, absolutely. It's you can raise ticket prices. You can use seat licensing fees and collect a giant one-time lump of money through that. It's all about that. Nickel and dime isn't quite right because it's a lot of money, but it's all about those little screws you can turn to make just a little bit more. And with so many of these deals, it's just because they can. If the owner sees an opportunity to make a little bit more money, why not? They're gonna get it. So I actually do write in the book that oftentimes you kind of can't blame the CEO or the sports team owner or whoever the case may be, because they're just grabbing what's available. I don't think anyone has an obligation to kind of leave benefits on the table, because no, it's for the greater good. If lawmakers are going to make bad policy, then the people who benefit, I think, kind of have a right to benefit.
It's funny that over and over in this book, lawmakers said to you, it's not like we're being held hostage, which sounds like too much protest.
Protest too much, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, hostage, blackmail, that's always the story that gets told. And again, there are a few reactions amongst lawmakers. One, but they're the bucket of people who know that this is nonsense but do it anyway because they're afraid of losing re-election. They're the bucket of people who believe the faux economic impact numbers. If the Chamber of Commerce tells them there's going to be a $300 million benefit, then they'll believe it no matter what, pointy-headed econ wonks like me say. And then there's the bucket of people who are just desperate, right? And you can see that in cities and towns all across America where they know this is a bad deal and they know their city's going to be paying for it in 25, 30 years when the, playground falls down and the roads collapse. But man, those 25 jobs at whatever the thing is right now are really going to feel good and they're going to help some people. So let's just make this the next guy's problem.
And that turns out to be really, really good for politicians, right? Like being seen to work to create jobs helps people get reelected.
Yeah. Perhaps the most distressing and fascinating bit of academic research I read while putting together the book is that, this is really good for reelection efforts. Lawmakers who engage in more corporate tax incentive deals, even if they don't actually end up winning whatever the thing in question is, just the effort that they go to try and make these deals happen correlates with better reelection prospects. And that does make a certain level of sense, right? If you're a politician, the press release saying, hey, we're trying to get Amazon to come here is worth something. The picture on the front page of the local, Times, Gazette, whatever, is worth something. The going to the ribbon cutting if you win the thing, and again, having your picture put on the front page of the paper is worth something. These all are ways for lawmakers to amass political capital, and voters, rightly or wrongly, assess their local lawmakers on this one thing.
So even if you take a fiscally responsible position in resisting this, it doesn't bode well for one's political career, right? To say no to this stuff.
Absolutely. And there's a giant prisoner's dilemma going on, right? Uh-huh. There's always someone who's willing to do it. Over the years, a bunch of states have tried to sort of form compacts. They come together and they say, okay, we're just poaching jobs from each other and this is all getting pretty silly, so let's not do that. And there's always a, one state house flips or one governor's office flips or one city gets desperate and breaks the pact. And as long as there's one person who's willing to say, all right, this is going to help me in the short term, so let's just do it, you're never going to stop this stuff.
Okay, let's talk about the movie business. Film productions, even TV shows now sometimes do location shoots in places beyond Hollywood. Sometimes they'll center their production in a city outside of California or New York. How did cities and states start to get into the business of trying to attract these productions and setting aside huge amounts of capital to do so?
Yeah, so it started really with Louisiana in 2002. They went really big on trying to win feature film and TV productions. And in the short term, it really did work. Tons of movies were being made in Louisiana, more than in California and New York, which is kind of remarkable if you think about it. But there was a big problem with subsidizing the movie industry in particular, which is that it's so transient and it's so short term. And we talk about hostage taking and blackmail. productions like that are so easy to move anywhere that Louisiana just ended up paying more and more and more and more to keep the same level of economic activity. Other states saw this was going on, and they said, all right, we'll jump in and let's do it, and more and more and more. By the end, you had about 44 states that had film and TV tax credit programs. So producers were just playing all these places off against each other, and we were spending upwards of $1 billion nationally annually subsidizing big movie and TV production. In the last few years, you've seen some states sort of knock it off. About 13 have cut their programs in the last few years. But for a while, it was the Wild West out there, and movies were going all over, up, down, all around in order to claim these tax credits.
And of course, there are there's money to be made with ancillary business, and you know, people need hotel space, and maybe local caterers get work. But it's not like some struggling actor in Bossier City is going to be the lead on a huge picture from Hollywood.
Absolutely. You inevitably end up subsidizing, you know, Ben Affleck's salary. You inevitably end up subsidizing the flights for big heavyweight producers to come in. But one of the other things to think about is that these are often such short-term jobs that you're really not taking an unemployed person and giving them a job, right? If someone's working in a hair salon and then comes and is a hairdresser on set for a few months, like, maybe that's great for them and maybe their pay went up and that's awesome and I don't want to disparage that. But that's not creating anything sustainable and new and a foundation for your economy, right? It's just renting that job for a few months until the production is done.
And then somebody's got to find another job.
Or they just go back to their previous job. Well, you know, all the time you see, hey, look at these benefits. We hired all these people, and it's just all off-duty police officers who are working security. It's like, those guys all have jobs.
Yeah, so it was just a little instant bonus for them. And again, I guess sometimes it's maybe good for tourist purposes. Not every film is complimentary to the place that it's located.
I lived in Baltimore when they decided to spend really big on House of Cards and Veep, the two political television shows. And for one, the hostage-taking absolutely did happen, and Veep and ended up leaving when California offered it more money than Maryland was willing to. But also you'd hear people saying, oh yeah, there's going to be all this tourism, and you look at the show and it's taking place in Washington, D.C., and there's the Capitol building. People aren't coming to Baltimore because of the show.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's talk about something that's a really big deal in this part of the country, and that is these like sports paradise mega stores like Cabela's and Bass Pro Shops. This one really surprised me. I had no idea that these kinds of businesses often come in for major government subsidies.
Absolutely. Bass Pro, about $1 billion. Cabela's, I want to say $500 million over the last decade or so. Yeah, they get a ton of money because they have this really good story to tell about being destination retail, right? That people are going to drive for hundreds of miles to come to these stores, and it's going to become a tourist attraction in its own right. And that's true to some extent, right? When the first few of these stores opened up, they really did draw people in, and they were a spectacle. But like so many corporations, the goal for the people who are running this business is to put them everywhere, right? It's to, so you don't have to drive 400 miles to get to one. So as these stores have proliferated, that effect is necessarily going to diminish. Then we start talking about the negative effects on the local economy. You have a giant sporting goods store that can sell everything. There's no need for all the small Main Street businesses that sold those sorts of things before.
What I've always wondered is why this sort of business and not that sort of business. If I run the world's greatest dry cleaner, why can't I go to my local city council or my state government and say I would like a subsidy to expand?
Absolutely. That's the huge question when it comes to this stuff. It's only the politically powerful and the politically connected that are able to get these sorts of deals. And that oftentimes leaves the small business and the Main Street business behind.
I didn't know that mega stores like Walmart and Target got subsidies.
Yeah, all the time. All the time to open big box stores. Usually property tax breaks, land grants, that sort of thing. We've been told this story that big business is the way to build an economy, and it's in order to be a serious economy, you need to have big businesses in your city or state. Not only do I think that's not true, I think those sorts of businesses are often actively destructive of the local economy. In a perfect world, we want cities and states to be competing on the sorts of things that build long-term sustainable growth for everyone, right? So like if I had my way and we got rid of all these corporate tax deals tomorrow, cities and states would have to compete on, hey, our schools are the best. Hey, our infrastructure is the best. Our quality of life is the highest, and it's really easy to raise a family here. And communities would sell themselves in that way and say, you know what, it would be a privilege for you. Your business should feel privileged to be in our community because our community is so great. That's the sort of stuff you want to be competing on, not who can rain as much money as possible down on corporate titans.
And of course, bringing in, you know, a big box store like a Target or a Walmart absolutely does come with probably dozens of new and permanent jobs. It's just that only a tiny percentage of those will be really well-paying jobs.
Yeah, there's that. And you also just end up shuffling a lot of activity around, right? So the people who used to work in the restaurant down the street or in the local hardware store or in the, you know, clothing store down the road end up taking the jobs in the big box store. And yeah, oftentimes seeing their pay cut.
So do local areas ever fight, you know, do the residents of these areas ever fight these kinds of subsidies? And how much can we know about them as voters?
So the big example currently is that Amazon HQ2 was chased out of New York, which I found pretty encouraging. I know it's oftentimes a minority opinion. The other two I point to is Boston saying no to the Olympics in 2020 and the Anaheim City Council in 2016 flipping because so much of the city's budget was being given to Disney, which really had a stranglehold on that city for a long time. But yeah, the problem, as we talked about earlier, is that there's so little transparency around these deals. Amazon was so unique because it was this big thing, and the Olympics were unique because they're this big thing, and Disney is Disney, and everyone knows what it is. But oftentimes, it can be hard to just find out really basic information because no one involved is really interested in being that transparent, right? The company doesn't really want to talk about the money it's getting. The lawmakers don't really want to talk about the money they're giving up. They just want to say, hey, the business came here and created these jobs, and don't really want you to know the details. So it can be really hard to get into the guts of these things. And that's not malicious. It's just in a lot of these places, it's, you know, the folks who are working in economic development offices are overworked and underpaid, and there just isn't enough time to really get this stuff out. And then there's a local media angle, right? These companies do a lot of work to sell the benefits of these deals and to say, hey, we're coming to your community. It's going to be great. Everything's going to be wonderful. And it takes a little time for someone like me to come running along and say, no, don't do it. And by that time, the story in the local paper's already been written.
Yeah. And of course, it's our money, right? Yours and mine as taxpayers. But we don't necessarily have the ability to access all the details of the deals.
Absolutely. And there's sort of a collective action problem, right? Like, it's really in the company's interest to make the deal happen. So they go all out in order to get it. Whereas the, like, interests of everybody else, like, oh, well, we probably shouldn't spend our money on this. We could probably spend it on something better. You have good government types. You have people who are interested in healthcare, people who are interested in education. There's no sort of cohesive lobby on the other side.
Pat Garofalo is with us from TalkPoverty.org. We're talking about his new book, The Billionaire Boondoggle, How Our Politicians Let Corporations and Bigwigs Steal Our Money and Jobs. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is managing editor for TalkPoverty.org at the Center for American Progress, Pat Garofalo. His book is called The Billionaire Boondoggle, How Our Politicians Let Corporations and Bigwigs Steal Our Money and Jobs. You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Okay, Pat, from a distance, I live in a place where gambling is not a thing. It seems like places that allow casino gaming must make money hand over fist. That has changed over the years. Tell us what the situation looks like now.
Absolutely. So once upon a time, when gambling was only legal in Atlantic City and Las Vegas, it really was an economy booster. That's what those cities became famous for. People came from all around to go there. They were mostly rich people who were kind of going out of their way to go to these cities to gamble. But as more and more states started getting into the gambling business, the benefits started diminishing, which makes sense, right? There's only so much gambling that can go on. There's only so much people are willing to spend in casinos. And so as more and more of them proliferated, they just started seeing fewer and fewer benefits. And so today, when we talk about states getting into the gambling business, it's often not, hey, we need to build a casino because we need to draw in tourists from the next three states and it's going to be great and we're going to bring in all these outside people. It's our residents are all leaving for outside states to go and gamble in those places. We need to keep them here. And, you know, at least if we're going to deal with the problems that come along with gambling addiction, we should try and get a little money too. So the way that this gets talked about rhetorically amongst lawmakers has really, really changed over the last few decades.
One exception you said is Native American casinos, which I guess are tribally run and distribute the profits only to members of the tribe.
Right. They sort of hit the perfect sweet spot when you're talking about economic development programs, because there's no reason for outside visitors to be coming there other than to be at the casino. And they employ pretty much 100% folks from the local community, and the money all pretty much stays in the local community. So they're a rare exception wherein this really does work. But again, we're talking about gambling, right? So there are social ills that come along with it. So you are making a bit of a bargain that you can deal with the downsides while benefiting from the upsides.
Many, many states have passed lotteries through their legislatures by saying they would pay for education. And then many, many states decided that all the money for education could come from the lottery. It's not like a lot of places got a net boost.
Yeah, I really hate the lottery. That's one of the things you take away from the book. It's that lotteries are bad. Yeah, oftentimes these games get sold as a way to boost particularly the education system. That's always the one because it sounds really good and it seems like a cheap and free way to raise money, right? This is fun. It's a game. We'll send out some scratch-out tickets. The money will wind up in the classroom. Everybody wins. When you hear everybody wins, you should really start getting nervous because...
Everybody loses.
Everybody loses, yeah. So what happens is... it's really easy to then take that money. You know, money is fungible when you're a government. You can spend it on anything you want. It's really easy to take that money and plop it somewhere else. So studies have shown that states that instituted lotteries to boost education spending don't boost education spending. They just take the money that they swap it out. So the money from the lottery does go into the classroom. The money that had been going into the classroom previously goes to something else. And then you start talking about who plays the lottery, and all of the studies show that it's primarily low-income people who play first. Richer people don't pile into the lottery until the jackpots get really, really high. So when you're talking about like $700 million Powerball, then richer folks start piling in because it's worth their time. But when you're talking about scratch-off tickets and the sort of lower denomination games, it's almost exclusively low-income people, and they're not playing because it's like fun and a distraction. They're playing out of economic desperation. And one of the most telling stats I came across is how lottery revenues spiked during the Great Recession, and it's because people were desperate.
Wow. So they felt like there was no way that they could ever save enough money to have financial security, but maybe if they spent $2, $3, $10 on the lottery, they might have a chance at winning.
Exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Diane in Euless. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I just wondered if... it could be addressed, and I apologize if it has been before because I tuned in late, but the fact that taxpayers subsidize the workers for a lot of these corporations because their wages are so low, as in food stamps, Medicaid, other things like that. So we're not only subsidizing the land and tax breaks that way, but we're also paying, you know, benefits out because their wages are so low.
Thanks for calling. What do you know about that, Pat?
That's a fantastic point, and that absolutely does happen. Oftentimes, these deals are not linked to any sort of job quality standard, and that's changing a little bit. Places are trying to get a little more cognizant that, hey, these jobs should not be paying poverty wages so that we end up paying for the job indirectly and then also for things like food stamps and Medicaid and whatever the case may be. But it's often because cities and states are in this prisoner's dilemma of somebody is always willing to make a worse deal in order to get the thing. It's really hard to enforce those sorts of standards. Amazon here in Northern Virginia, there was a vote on Saturday to give them the last tiny slice of the subsidy money they're getting to come to the D.C. area. It was only $23 million, and it was the money that the county was going to pay for Amazon instead of just the state, which gave the bulk of the money. And local activists really wanted there to be a living wage requirement in that deal, and the county board didn't do it. And that's really unfortunate because that, at the very least, should be a part of these deals.
Not to mix my internet companies here, but I wonder if there's something of like an eBay effect going on, which is to say everybody is pretty, you know, smart and wants to make money rather than lose money. But once the bidding starts, it's really easy to get carried away because you're so close that you feel like if you just put in another, whatever, $10 million from your city, $100 million, you could get that thing that you've been trying to get.
100%. I think that's absolutely right. And there is a very much everyone's doing it dynamic to these things, and lawmakers feel like they will be blamed if they don't participate. There was a survey that came out a few weeks ago. It came out too late for me to include in the book, but where mayors were surveyed, and they generally thought that these deals were okay, not great. The deals they made were really good, and the deals every other mayor made were really extravagant and out of control. I thought it was really telling. So like they sort of knew that this is out of whack and not a great thing, but they wanted to blame it on everybody else and say, oh, but my deals are perfect. They're really good.
It's like everybody thinks they got a great deal on their car, right?
Absolutely.
Everyone else
yeah.
got taken. So I mean, we're smart people. We don't want to waste money. We don't want our money wasted by other people. What kinds of questions can we ask when our elected leaders start talking about a deal that they're working on to lure some company or sports team or whatever to our area?
The first one I would ask is honestly just, you know, what's in the deal? What are you spending on it? Are there the sort of living wage requirements that we talked about earlier? But then ask, and this is a really crucial question to me, what is going to go unfunded if we do this thing? If we decide to forego $50 million in property taxes to Lore and Amazon, what are we not going to use that $50 million for, right? Could we not find $50 million to spend on our schools, to spend on our infrastructure? That, to me, sort of gets to the crux of this, because there's a huge opportunity cost to these deals. Everything you do with a bit of money means you can't do something else. So that, to me, would be the sort of first thing to get out of the gate.
So with all due respect to this book, which I think does an amazing job at giving us a general nationwide overview of this issue, it did also make me think about the importance of local journalism, right? You need someone who's paying attention to the details of whatever's happening in your specific city or state.
100,000%. Yeah, there's no way for any one person or one organization to cover the waterfront on these. I think that's a really crucial point, and I haven't looked at it, but I would imagine that there is some correlation between the dearth of local journalism in a place, particularly good investigative journalism, and more of these deals happening, or at least the details of them not being as easily accessible.
Is there a lot of lobbying by these companies to try and drive up the offers that they receive? What do you know about the negotiation process between a city and a company? It's almost like an old fashioned fairy tale where someone's family has to come up with money to like buy them a husband.
That stuff certainly does happen, and the companies have gotten very good about sort of packaging the deal. And they'll go into a town, they'll sign up for the local chamber of commerce, they'll sponsor a softball team, they'll go visit the local politicians, they'll throw campaign donations down. There's like what you think happens probably does happen. I don't think I'm telling any new story on this particular aspect.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about a corporate headquarters, what does that entail exactly? I mean, usually there's a big building and there's executives. Is there any way to know how much money those executives bring into a local economy? Is there like a rough rule of thumb that you can calculate? If there are 75 executives in a building, will that put, $10 billion in 10 years into your economy? I honestly don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. There's no way to really nail that down. And that actually gets to, I think we talked about it earlier, one of the problems with these deals is so much of the money leaks out to other places. And so, if you have, you have an executive there and maybe he buys a nice big house, but he also buys a yacht two states away, or he's, flying his plane to whatever rich city and spending a bunch of money there. So much of this money escapes back out of the local community because you're using a bank shot. You're tossing some money at a corporation, expecting it to do a thing, and then expecting to reap the benefits instead of just spending the money and reaping the benefits yourself.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The one thing I started wondering about reading this book was why jurisdictions, taxing entities that offer these deals, don't write a requirement in them that a certain number of jobs that have been promised will actually materialize. That part surprises me, that you can promise 15,000 jobs, bring four, and still have every penny that you were given as a subsidy.
Yeah, they do sometimes, and I think I said earlier, it's gotten a little more popular to do that. Foxconn in Wisconsin, which was an example, wherein they did actually say you have to create these jobs before you get the money, and now that Foxconn isn't creating those jobs, it's not going to get all of the money. It's still going to get some up front. But I think this just gets back to, it's so hard to stand your ground when other cities and states are willing to say, nope, we'll do it for anything. Here, have whatever you want. Because there's always this prisoner's dilemma. And if you're the guy who at the end says, oh, I'm really going to try and hold the line on that living wage or on that job creation metric, maybe the thing goes elsewhere.
There's another sentence in the book that will stick with me, and that is that people love their sports teams and their sports teams don't love them back. Are we making a mistake feeling loyal to our favorite hometown team?
Not to the team, but you're making a mistake in thinking that the owner is interested in your feelings. the sports teams are a business, and the owner is out to oftentimes to make money. And there are good owners out there. I don't want to disparage every single one, but this is a money making vessel for them, right? And if they feel like they can make more money somewhere else, they're going to do it. And so treating it like it. We often talk about our sports teams as if they are a civic asset, right? And as if they're owned by the local community, and they're just not.
One thing before I let you go that I want to talk about is cities that own hotels. What is that all about?
Yeah,
and do they make money off them?
This is one of the things that surprised me the most was the extent to which we have what one researcher called hotel socialism in this country. Cities have spent about $8 billion on about 120-ish hotels subsidizing their creation. And some of them are literally outright owned by the city. There's a famous one about an hour away from me in Baltimore, the Baltimore Hilton, which was paid for, owned, operated, run by the city. It is completely on the city's books. All of its most of the time losses are on the city's books. It was supposed to make money just a few years in. It did not turn a profit for its first decade. And this has happened all over. Trenton, New Jersey famously went all in on a hotel and ended up selling it in bankruptcy for pennies on the dollar. And for some reason, cities have decided that when they can't generate enough tourism business, the hotel is going to be the thing that does it, which just strikes me as really odd. If you don't have enough demand for a hotel in the place, literally building the hotel doesn't do anything. Have you ever, you know, maybe people have, but I don't go, let me see where I can find the best hotel and that's the place I want to visit, right? Like that doesn't create tourist demand on its own.
The other thing that's somewhat related is this really wild arms race that exists all over the country with regard to convention centers. If there's not a lot of business, cities are like, you know what, let's double the space of our convention center. That makes no sense to me.
Yeah, and it often goes hand in hand with the hotel, right? The city builds the convention center, and it doesn't result in the boom of conventions. So they say, oh, but you know what? We'll build the hotel, and then people will come. The problem is it's a lot like gambling. There are only so many conventions that can go around. There are only so many trade associations. There are only so many of these things that can occur in one year. And so cities end up just sort of taking them from each other rather than building anything new. When they build a convention center, sadly, I think I pointed out in the book, the high point for D.C.'s convention center, which was built on these with all these grand promises that didn't fulfill, was when Hurricane Katrina went through New Orleans and a bunch of conventions had to relocate because of the storm. And that was the time when D.C. boomed. And that's a problem with these deals writ large, right? Oftentimes, you're just shuffling economic activity around. You're not creating anything new. You're not building a foundation. So you are quite literally building your economy by taking from someone else. When a job leaves from California to go to Texas, when a job moves from Florida to Georgia, when a job moves from New York to New Jersey, it's at the expense of the other place, not because you're creating something new and sustainable and really boosting your economy that way. And I just really wish it didn't work like that.
Pat Garofalo is managing editor for TalkPoverty.org at the Center for American Progress. His book is called The Billionaire Boondoggle: How Our Politicians Let Corporations and Bigwigs Steal Our Money and Jobs. Pat, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Thank you so much. It's been great.